It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. For more than 3 years, the state of Wisconsin has been providing bottled water to about 1,500 residents in the town of Campbell on French Island because their wells are contaminated with PFAS chemicals.
But now local officials and scientists are exploring a potential source of clean drinking water for the western Wisconsin community, the deep Mount Simon aquifer that stretches across much of Wisconsin.
But the big question, have the toxic chemicals seeped into that aquifer? This month, researchers started drilling wells to determine the risk of PFAS contamination in this deep water source.
Lee Donahue is a town of Campbell supervisor joining us now for a firsthand look. Lee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for the invitation to join.
Well, you've had this shallower aquifer that is the source of all these PFAS problems right now. What led to this research now on this deeper aquifer?
Well, a couple of things. There is a USGS installation here on the island that has been using that Mount Simon aquifer for a number of years. We know that it's PFAS-free. It's tested quarterly. And then also right across the river from us is the city of La Crescent, who has also been using that deep Mount Simon aquifer for upwards of a decade. And we know that it's PFAS-free. But we do continually test it just to make sure nothing's changed.
Now, we've got this team, I understand, drilling a few different testing wells at depths going from 85 to 400 feet in your community. Talk about this current status of this test. What are they doing? What are they looking for here?
Sure. So last year in February, the town of Campbell actually drilled a test well 500 feet into the Mount Simon, and we tested extensively at that time, so we knew that it was PFAS-free. This research team from UW-Madison, along with USGS and Wisconsin Geological Survey, is doing research to investigate the characteristics of the rock layer that lies between the contaminated upper aquifer and the deep non-contaminated aquifer. So these three new monitoring wells will allow us to sample at levels of 400 feet, roughly 200 feet, and 80 feet to see in the upper aquifer how the plume is moving and migrating, and then in the deep aquifers to make certain that nothing is getting through that barrier of rock.
So the hope is that, in fact, no, the PFAS isn't seeping down into that lower aquifer. The worry is, of course, that it might be. When will these tap drills figure out, when will we know what that spread looks like from the drilling over the last couple of weeks?
So far, we have never found evidence of PFAS in that deep aquifer. And again, the city of La Crescent does continuous testing. USGS property does continuous testing, and we've done testing on the test well, and will now do further testing on the 200 and 400 foot monitoring wells in that deep aquifer. But we have not found any. But part of the reason is this deep aquifer is part of an ancient river system. And because of that, there has been no human activity that has been able to migrate down those hundreds and hundreds of feet. And that's why we feel pretty confident that that rock barrier that's been there for thousands of years is really a very good protection between those two aquifers.
If we continue to not find PFAS down there, it looks like clean water. What would it take then to make this the source of water for the town of Campbell?
Sure. So we drilled the test well last year, and now we expect to drill a municipal well within the next 3 months. And after we continue to test that to make certain that it truly is PFAS-free, we'll start building out our municipal system from there.
Lee Donahue is with us from the town of Campbell, supervisor there, talking about their long-running PFAS problem, hopes for being able to tap into this deeper PFAS-free aquifer as a source of drinking water. Lee, when we're talking about towns, a lot of times we're talking about people with well water, and you're talking about a municipal water source. Would this be a change for your community coming together and having this one water source?
Absolutely. Everybody in the town of Campbell is currently on a private well. We are very similar to the town of Peshtigo, where people are on private wells. So moving to a municipal system is one way that we can guarantee that all of our residents will have access to a new long-term safe water source.
All right. Deeper well sounds to me like it'd be a more expensive well. What does the expense look like here?
Yeah, so roughly $200,000 to develop, between $200,000 and $500,000 to develop this well. And something that folks need to know is that there are other contaminants in this deep aquifer that needs to be filtered. So iron, manganese, and radium. But those are so much less expensive to filter that in comparison to PFAS, it's much, much less expensive. So we don't want folks trying to poke a lot of holes 500 feet in their backyard thinking that they're just going to be able to tap into that and turn on their faucet and have safe water. There are still things that need to be filtered out. But again, as a municipal system, that's one thing that's it's easy for a municipality to constantly monitor.
Speaking of money, a state news story I imagine you're watching pretty closely, this PFAS trust fund created in the state's two-year spending plan. Governor Evers signed that last July, but hang on, it needs a new law to say, okay, where is this money going to go? That's on hold. Disagreement between the governor and Republicans in the state legislature about certain laws on the how this is all regulated and enforced. Is this holding up some action for you? Were you looking at this as a potential pool of money for this deeper well or other solutions?
Absolutely. I think every PFAS contaminated community in the state is looking toward that trust fund as a source of at least partial funding for whatever their solution is going to be. And I want to point out that there is already a mechanism that was approved years ago, potentially decades ago, and that is the Safe Drinking Water Loan Program. The DNR already has a mechanism of how they authorize and prioritize communities for water loans based upon nitrates or other emerging contaminants. So really, the mechanism already exists. It's just a matter of the fact that Joint Finance Committee needs to authorize that mechanism, which is tried and true, to be applied in this case.
Have you heard anything from the Joint Finance Committee suggesting that there might be progress on that funding solution?
Unfortunately, all of my conversations say that this may not be taken up until the next budget session, roughly a year from now. And folks can't wait. We're in a health crisis. We can't wait another 6 months, another year to access money that was bipartisanly approved.
The Department of Natural Resources has been supplying bottled water to a good chunk of the town, 1,500 residents, as we mentioned. This is going on for 3 years. Just give us a taste of what that's like for people having to deal with this water, using it for, as I understand it, just about everything that we might use tap water for.
Yeah, and let me just clarify, that's roughly 1,600 households. We have 4,300 residents in Campbell. So imagine manipulating big, heavy 5-gallon jugs that have to be in a climate controlled area. Otherwise, they'll freeze and break during the winter. And you have to, you know, physically manipulate this heavy thing for all of your drinking and your cooking and watering your pets. Folks here don't garden for the most part in their backyard anymore, simply because we know that that shallow aquifer, which our garden hoses are tapped into, is contaminated.
What do you know, Lee, about the sources of contamination in Campbell and on French Island?
Well, the city of La Crosse has taken responsibility for one section of the town of Campbell, which is due south of the airport. But history shows that there are numerous activities by the airport that really include the entire perimeter of that property. And we believe that is what's responsible for the contamination here.
Lee, I'm kind of by nature maybe a pessimistic person. If I were in your shoes now, I guess I'd be trying not to get my hopes up too much that this problem is going to be solved soon. Are you more optimistic than I am? Are you feeling like, hey, there might be some light at the end of the tunnel here?
Oh, I'm the eternal optimist. And I do believe that not only will we see a municipal water system in the next handful of years, but in my lifetime and in my neighbor's lifetimes, they'll be able to reach over to their tap and turn it on and actually put a glass underneath it and be able to safely drink it again.
And briefly, Lee, when are you hoping to see the results from this test drilling to see what the PFAS flow is looking like underground?
Sure. We anticipate doing sampling within the next 30 days. And then, generally speaking, it's about a 30-day turnaround with the state lab here down in Madison.
Lee, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Lee Donahue, a supervisor in the town of Campbell on French Island. Local officials and researchers there are testing a deep aquifer in hopes that it could be a source of clean drinking water for residents. This all comes 3 years after PFAS contamination was found in residential wells. And hey, if you are living in a community with PFAS problems, tell us your current state of affairs. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
And this is Wisconsin Today. You're tuned into the new WPR News station. And thank you so much for joining us. We have a one-day member drive coming up next week, but you can help right now.
Get a head start. When 500 people give before that one-day drive, a group of generous current members are going to donate an extra $10,000.
WPR is more than a radio station. It is a public service to the people of Wisconsin, and your community, your contribution fuels our commitment to this service.
Give to WPR right now so that everybody around Wisconsin has access to high quality journalism and to meaningful conversations. You can help us meet this pre-drive goal when you give right now. Do it for you and for all of Wisconsin.
Yes, join in now ahead of our one-day member drive. You can give at wpr.org/donate. That's give at wpr.org/donate.
You may have noticed a couple few changes here at Wisconsin Public Radio. A lot of thought, a lot of work went into these changes. By people, not me. I didn't really do much. I helped out a little bit. A lot of work went into this, and I hope you are appreciating what we're doing now, trying to give you the best service we can. We can only do that because of support from people like you through the decades, the century we've been on the air. Give right now at wpr.org/donate, and thank you so much.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, the state Supreme Court is on track to issue a record low number of rulings in the session that wraps up this month.
When you're only issuing, say, 15 decisions, hardly any issues are being addressed.
Find out what could be leading to the low caseload coming up here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The current one-year term of the Wisconsin Supreme Court runs through the end of the month. Some important cases remain on the docket, but overall, the state court has tackled way fewer cases than usual.
According to an analysis from the blog SCOW Stats, that's S-C-O-W Stats, like Supreme Court of Wisconsin, the state Supreme Court is expected to finish this term with fewer than 20 total decisions issued.
That would mark the fewest cases of any term since at least 1980 and less than half the number it issued last year.
So what's going on and why? Alan Ball is professor of history at Marquette University. He runs the SCOW Stats blog that tracks data on state Supreme Court decisions. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, just a couple weeks yet until the end of the current state Supreme Court term. Talk about what we're seeing when it comes to just the sheer number of cases that they're cranking through in this session.
Well, that's been one of the most dramatic features about the current term, at least so far, that based on what I've seen, it looks to me like the maximum number of decisions that they're going to file by the end of the term would be something like 14 or 15, that I don't count a handful of things like if, say, they dismiss a case as improvidently granted, which means they say basically, whoops, we shouldn't have taken that case, and then they don't decide it. There have been a couple of those. I'm not counting them. And then there were a couple that were deadlocked, 3-3, where one justice recuses herself for some reason or another, and they can't decide it. And so it just goes back to whatever the lower court's ruling were. There were a couple of those. If we discount those, then I think the maximum number of cases they're going to have is maybe 14 or 15. And this is stunningly low. that if you look at, say, the past, oh, say, four terms or so, the average may be around 50 cases per term. It bounces around, you know, maybe upper 40s, low 50s. And to put that in even, you know, broader perspective, if you look at a couple of the justices who have either recently retired or are going to retire, when they first joined the court was routinely deciding 80 cases per term, you know, somewhere in that neighborhood, plus or minus a few. And as recently as, say, 2005, 2006, they were filing 80, 81 decisions. So to plunge all the way down to, say, 15 is remarkable. It's maybe a drop of like two-thirds, 67% compared to what they were filing just last year.
So, Alan, 15-ish cases as opposed to, as you said, the norm of 50-ish cases. What are some of the reasons that the court might be tackling so many fewer cases?
Well, that's, of course, question number one. And there are a number of different factors that might have played a part. One is that in theory and often in practice, the Supreme Court is supposed to be what's called a court that takes law development cases, which means sort of big picture cases where they're confining themselves to deciding issues that have not been ruled on before, or say taking cases where the lower courts have been split in conflict and they have to resolve that. And they leave to the lower courts what are often called error correction cases, which are just focused more narrowly on a particular case. Did, say, the lower court make the circuit court make it a good decision or a bad decision? They're not supposed to take those cases. And so it's possible that someone could argue that there have just been fewer law development cases this term. I am skeptical about that. I think if we could question pretty much any appellate attorney in Milwaukee, in Wisconsin, that they would all agree that there are far more cases out there that deserve Supreme Court attention than simply 15. But someone might argue that there are fewer than normal, and that might have played a part. Though, as I say, I don't think that could be the major factor.
One story that people might have expected was, okay, last year's election, we now have a liberal majority in the state Supreme Court for, depending on who you talk to, the first time in 15 years or the first time in maybe ever. We'll maybe talk a little bit more about that, Alan. But the thought might be, okay, oh, liberal court. A lot of people might say, hey, let's test things. Let's see if the liberal court, if it's a liberal group, will move in our direction now. We might have expected to see more people try to drive cases up to the Supreme Court.
Yes. That's plausible. You could also imagine that the four liberal justices might be inclined to take as many cases as they could if now they have a chance to develop the law in a direction that's more congenial to them. Obviously, that's not happened. And also, it only takes three justices to decide to accept a case for review. And so if, say, the conservatives wanted to take more cases, they could. There's still three there, and any combination of three liberals could. And clearly, that's not happened. I think if you're trying to make that argument, that is that we have a liberal court and that's somehow or another correlated with a much smaller number of cases, then maybe you could point to the friction that was evident, the polarization that was evident even from the beginning of the term, when there was, you know, the justices were making no effort to hide their animosity over, say, changes in court administrative procedures or court personnel. There's certainly no doubt about that there has been friction, animosity, polarization, and someone might think, well, somehow or another that's bogged down the court and could account to some extent for the fewer cases. There may be something to that. On the other hand, you can certainly look back in the past and find plenty of other periods in the court history where there's been a lot of animosity, polarization, say in the early Scott Walker period. When
allegations of violence among court justices, for example.
Right. With Justice Prosser and Ann Welsh Bradley. Even before that, say, and I think it was 1999, there were a trio of justices that were so unhappy with the Chief Justice, Shirley Abramson, that they even campaigned against her. And then, of course, more recently in 2015, when the conservatives ousted Shirley Abramson as Chief Justice. So you can certainly find periods where there's say, intemperate language, clear hostility, even physical altercations, as you mentioned. And in none of those times was there a corresponding plunge in the number of cases. So while the friction, the polarization in the current term has certainly been pronounced, there's no denying that. To say, well, that has to explain the sharp drop in cases, I think is insufficient. I mean, another factor that could well have played a part, and I imagine would occur to people reflecting on this, would be that, well, the court has taken a number of provocative, important, politicized cases this year, the redrawing of the electoral maps, the separation of powers case of, you know, can legislative committees veto actions by the administrative branch, or the case involving absentee ballots and drop boxes, and of course the impending abortion cases. There have been a number of prominent politicized cases, and you could imagine that that would absorb an unusual amount of the justices' time and could help account for the smaller number of decisions coming out. And, you know, there may well be something there. Again, on the other hand, though, if you look back in the past, there have been times when the court has also wrestled with a number of provocative, politicized, high-profile cases, such as, again, in the early Walker years, the Act 10 cases, you know, reducing the power of public employee unions, voter ID, or more recently, the flurry of cases involving what the government could do regarding COVID-19 or the challenges to the 2020 election. So there certainly have been, you know, spasms, if you will, of provocative cases in the past that have not resulted in a plunging number of decisions. So, you know, there's perhaps something there, but no individual reason seems to be the silver bullet or the explanation to it all. Another possibility could be, and I won't know until I look into this at the end of the term when all the decisions are in, that someone might argue, well, the justices are writing longer decisions than in the past, or maybe there are more separate opinions, that is, concurrences or dissents for each decision in the past, and that could be slowing things down. Those numbers jump up and down over the years, and it's not clear to me that the decisions are so much longer that could account for this stunning drop. But again, maybe that played some part in what we're seeing here as well.
We're talking to Alan Ball from Marquette, looking at the Wisconsin Supreme Court issuing what looks to be a historically low number of decisions this term. You can follow his analysis of the state's Supreme Court on his blog, SCOW Stats, S-C-O-W, as in Supreme Court of Wisconsin Stats. Alan, is there a judgment here saying, okay, it's bad that the Supreme Court is just taking on too few cases? Or was it bad that they were taking on too many cases? Is there a value assessed on the raw number in their workload?
Well, if you're trying to put the best face on it that you can, if, say, any of those seven justices that you reached out to actually responded to your question, they might say, yes, we're issuing fewer decisions, but what we are issuing are much better decisions, you know, maybe more thoroughly researched or, you know, more substantial in terms of their legal analysis and thus more helpful. They would probably offer something along those lines. On the other side, though, of course, when you're only issuing, say, 15 decisions, hardly any issues are being addressed. And if you think across all the possible areas of legal concern in Wisconsin, you know, civil cases, criminal cases, there are a staggering number of issues that are of interest to various parties, and hardly any of those are being addressed at all when the number is down to 15. And so I would say that would be a considerable downside. And it's I can't imagine there are many people celebrating this, you know, saying that this is the way things should be in the future, simply because so many issues are not getting the attention that various litigants would desire. And thus, say, if you're an appellate attorney, if you're a lower court, if you're the state, say, district attorneys or the attorney general's office, none of those entities are receiving much guidance regarding a large number of issues that are likely to come up.
Another piece of state Supreme Court data you've been tracking through the years is polarization. Do justices we call conservative or liberal actually vote as conservative and liberal blocks? Now, we're waiting on a lot of decisions. We don't have the data in place for this current term with that new liberal majority. But in the past, when we in the media say a conservative bloc or a liberal bloc voting together, does the data bear that out? Do justices vote as what we consider these political blocs?
Very frequently so, yes. I've done some posts on that in the past, and you can find, I think I, in fact, did a post with something like the title of Block Cohesion, you know, with that question in mind. And it was pretty striking if you looked at, say, depending on who the liberals or the conservatives were at the time, but if it was, say, for the liberals, Anne Walsh Bradley and Rebecca Dalit and Jill Karofsky, that they could be voting together, either all three in the majority or all three dissenting a very high degree of the time, say in the maybe, you know, somewhere between 80-90% of cases, they would all be voting together. And you could find a similar degree of cohesion among the conservatives on the court. This term, at least so far, and again, there's only been a small number of decisions filed, but the last time I checked, the four liberals, were all voting together in all of the cases. Again, only five or six cases the last time I checked. But if that anything close to that continues through the rest of the term, that would be unprecedented to have four justices, not just three. And it's hard enough to find three justices, you know, that vote together 80 or 90% of the time. But if you had four voting together 80 or 90% of the time, that would certainly be noteworthy. And it'll be something that I'll be looking for. And again, the conservatives too, as well, in recent terms have voted together remarkably frequently. And so if that's one measure of, say, polarization, that is that in a contentious, controversial, politicized case, that you can almost invariably predict before the decision even comes out, you know, which, say, three or four justices will be here and which three or four justices will be there. I think that that could be one indication of the polarization that you mentioned.
An interesting thing you wrote, I think it was about a year ago, a little after the election of Justice Protasiewicz, tipping to that liberal majority. We had a 15-ish year conservative majority in the courts. And with that election, some of us in the media said first liberal majority in 15 years. You wrote, hang on, when we go back before that long conservative dominance, it was a little different. Can you paint us a picture of what it was like before then?
Well, the reason that many commentators said, well, the first liberal court in 15 years or so was that they were thinking back to the time when on the court for the liberals, we had Shirley Abramson, Anne Walsh Bradley, and Lewis Butler. And then the question is, who would be the fourth vote for that so-called liberal majority? And it would either come from Justice Crix or Prosser. And I looked into that and found that those two, Justices Crix and Prosser, were slightly more inclined during the 4 years that Lewis Butler was on the court, were slightly more inclined to side with the conservatives than they were with the liberals. So that's why, to me, the current court with four justices, now with Justice Protasiewicz, who are all voting together almost all the time or so far all the time, seems much more clearly a liberal court than one where you have these sort of swing votes of Prosser, you know, maybe going with the liberals, maybe going with the conservatives, back and forth. I think the reason that that court during the Butler years, in retrospect, seemed liberal was because it became so much more conservative once you have the arrival of people like Justice Gableman or later Dan Kelly, Rebecca Bradley. It became overwhelmingly conservative with only two liberals, Shirley Abramson and Anne Walsh Bradley, voting often in 5-2 minorities. You know, you could find, say, a really, really large number of 5-2 decisions during those years with Shirley Abramson and Anne Walsh Bradley being the two and the conservatives being the five. And so that was, you know, sort of the high point of conservative dominance. And in retrospect, then that the Butler years seemed liberal, but not nearly so much as what we have right now.
As we wrap up, what decisions, big decisions, are you waiting for to drop over the next, couple of weeks?
Well, I'm curious to see what happens with the abortion decisions. You know, whether how far how those move along, what issues seem pertinent. Otherwise, it's apart from those. I'm just more curious about the kind of polarization issues that we mentioned. You know, whether in fact we go through an entire term with almost total alignment between the four liberals. I'm also curious to see how things end up looking for Justice Hagedorn, because recently he was tremendously important in 4-3 decisions. That is, it was close to impossible to win a 4-3 decision without him, that either you had three conservatives or three liberals, and whichever way he went would tip it. But now with Justice Protasiewicz, he's become, so to speak, superfluous or unnecessary for the liberals. They can win without him. And I'll be curious to see what, once we get through the 15 decisions, has changed with regard to his role, because he was the closest thing to a swing vote in recent years, that he sometimes did vote with the liberals, sometimes voted with the conservatives. He was the most difficult by far to predict, you know, how he was going to vote. And thus he was tremendously important when you had three liberals and three conservatives. Now we have four liberals. And so I'll be curious to see how his role has changed.
Alan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Alan Ball is a professor of history at Marquette University. He talked to us about a drop in the number of cases being decided by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. You can follow his work tracking the state Supreme Court on his blog. It's called Scow Stats.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a Madison nonprofit aims to help foster youth at a critical time in their lives, helping them secure housing as they age out of the system.
And our systems aren't set up to support youth in transitioning into young adulthood.
We learn about the Unhoused Youth Initiative. That's ahead here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. New transitional housing in Madison aims to reduce homelessness among young adults who age out of foster care. The National Foster Youth Institute says 20,000 young Americans move into this transitional age each year.
The Madison-based nonprofit Urban Triage calls its latest effort a first of its kind in Wisconsin. For a look at the Unhoused Youth Initiative, we have Brandy Grayson, CEO of Urban Triage. Brandy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me as a guest.
Your organization is in the midst of designing and renovating this transitional living space in Dane County for young adults who have aged out of foster care. Why do Wisconsin communities need this type of transitional housing?
Well, you know, very similar to other communities across our country, we have a epidemic that I believe we have been ignoring. And the epidemic really is around the number of children and youth that are housed within our Child Protective Service institution or system of Child Protective Services. And when children leave this system, when they graduate from the system, which is at the age of 18, they are left without anything. A lot of the children that go through or are in foster homes don't have parents, don't have relatives, have nowhere to go. And our systems aren't set up to support youth in transitioning into young adulthood. So I believe transitional housing facilities like the one that we're cultivating is needed all through our country. So I'm super excited that Dane County Human Services has chosen us as their contractor to do the work. We have experience with housing folks throughout our Dane County, and we have experience working with populations that are vulnerable. So we're really excited for the opportunity, and more so the opportunity to serve our youth.
When youth get to that really pivotal time around the age of 18. I'm going to use the word triage. I would imagine that, as your organization's name says, you do a bunch of triage to find out what is needed for this age group. What do you hear?
A lot of folks, you know, we do a lot of youth engagement and we work with youth in our high schools. And a lot of the youth say the same thing. One, adults don't listen to us. Two, there's nothing for us to do. Three, we don't know how to get a job. Three, four, I'm losing count. I don't have the skills to get a job or interview for a job, or I don't know how to fill out applications, or how do I get an apartment? What's required of me? What should I be doing? How do I manage a bank account? A lot of our young folks have never written a check. They haven't used anything outside a Cash App and a Cash App card. So banking information, financial literacy is something that we'll be supporting them with, tenant rights, contracts, negotiations for their lease, personal development, enrolling in schools, how to budget, right? How do you budget? How do you pay your bills? What are your priorities? What are some supports and resources that you can tap into to supplement some of your bills, whether it's food stamps or medical assistance? How do you apply for those things? What's the qualifications? What's expected? So those are the things, like the things that we as adults think that everyone just automatically knows, like how to do, which is really navigate life. Youth have communicated over and over again through to us and through data that they really don't know. Like, they're not learning this information in school. It's not something like they teach you in the life class. They teach you how to change a baby diaper, but they're not teaching financial literacy or navigating systems or applications or how to be presentable and things like that. So that's what we hear a lot of. And we'll be doing that inside the house, providing those services, those wraparound services, and then supporting youth in transitioning into permanent housing and helping them save up money and things like that, and personal leadership and development. And most important to me is the trauma recovery, because a lot of the kids and youth that are coming out of systems and foster care, they don't have, they're coming with trauma and they don't have access or a history of therapy or other services that's needed.
Brandy, with that type of trauma, are these young adults more susceptible to falling into homelessness?
Absolutely. Homelessness, sex trafficking, drugs, criminal activities, because, you know, desperate times require desperate measures. So a lot of our youth fall into unhealthy environments and situations because they're alone and they don't have the support. They don't have the guidance. They don't know what to do. So they're really living by chance a lot of times when they're aging out of foster care.
Living by chance. So in Wisconsin, age 18, is that a hard and fast age in terms of services and what is offered to these young people?
Generally speaking, yes. Sometimes we're able to, and this is I'm speaking from now the lens of a foster mom. I provide treatment foster care to children with high emotional and behavior issues. And the only time that I've been able to advocate for youth staying longer in the system or the foster care system is when they have cognitive disabilities. So if they have cognitive disabilities or physical disabilities that, you know, just affects them, but it has to be chronic. It can't just be anxiety or depression or suicide. It has to be chronically disabling, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And then they can stay in the system maybe to 19, 20 if you get a court order.
So, Brandy, looking at your numbers here, last year providing housing services for more than 3,000 young adults, urban triage, finding permanent housing for 225 young adults. I was looking at your housing resource list and what is available and the cost of housing. What challenges do these young adults face when trying to find a place to live?
A lot of challenges. So we have I mean, I just don't even know where to stay, right? Because most of the apartment complexes or, you know, landlords are requiring 3 to 4 times the amount of rent, right? And we are talking about a one bedroom, $1,100. And then they're also requiring a good credit score, rental history. And if you don't have those things, they're requiring co-signers. But when you're coming from a system, you don't have access to those things. Those things are a privilege that they don't have. They just don't have. Yeah, I guess I would just say that.
We have Brandy Grayson with us, who leads the Madison nonprofit Urban Triage, as we talk about housing needs for young adults who are aging out of foster care. Brandy, recently WPR spoke with Christine Nadelsky from the state's Education for Homeless Children and Youth program. And let's listen to Nadelsky talking about doubled up homelessness or when youth live in temporary situations with family or friends.
It really is kind of that hidden homelessness that we don't think about. A lot of times people just think homelessness is an individual on the street or maybe folks living in their car. But really, these doubled up situations are very unstable.
With these doubled up situations, is this a common issue for the young adults you serve?
Oh, yeah, young adults and adults. We have a lot of families that come through Urban Triage who are doubled up. And a lot of times it's folks, you know, we see a lot of it with immigrant families and with young folks who are what we call couch surfing, just going to house to have a place to stay. It's unstable. And a lot of times it's unsafe. So the challenge, again, is the way that HUD and most funders define homelessness is based on living on the streets, living in your car, or living outside in some place that's inhabitable, right? And oftentimes, if someone says, hey, I'm couch surfing, I'm doing these things to get by, then it disqualifies them. So not only is it a big challenge, it's an area in which we're lacking resources and supports, and not just with doubled up, but with housing stability, because we do have youth and other young adults that find housing, but then they need support along the way to maintain housing, and there's no resources. There's nowhere for people to go when they get sick and miss work for 2 weeks, because folks are living check to check, you know, to survive in this economy. So if there's a mishap or something occurs, your child is sick, you miss too much work because your kid is sick, now you're fired, now you need to get a new job, and it takes 30 days to do that, now you're behind, now you're facing eviction, now you're facing more stress, and there's no support services currently available in our community for those families.
Can you talk a bit about the Unhoused Youth Initiative and how there might be some safety net there in that transition as we look at all of these different challenges that these young people are facing?
Yeah, so our Unhoused Youth Initiative really is designed to not only provide the support services and wraparounds, but designed to support youth in understanding how to navigate the systems, how to save for emergencies, how to access resources, and how to overcome moments of obstacles and stress. Because a lot, too often, whether we're talking about young adults or people my age, and let's just say I'm close to 50, sometimes we don't know what we don't know, and we haven't developed the skills or capacity to overcome challenges. When, you know, sometimes, you know, for me, when my car breaks down, I just go to the shop. For folks who don't have access to resources to fix their car, it becomes life-changing for them. And it could change into, you know, it can change their life direction in terms of getting to work, getting their kid to school. And then that could feel like hitting rock bottom to them, something that some of us would see simply as a repair need. So I see our job as an organization and as folks who support folks who are vulnerable is to teach people how to thrive through and survive those obstacles, those life obstacles, what we call or identify as lifing, right? And then helping them and helping investors and funders fund those things that people need. Like, so if I have my car breakdown and it's life or death for me, we need to make sure in our community there's resources, right? Because everybody doesn't have family to call or mom or dad or a cousin or someone they can loan from or borrow from. And I think sometimes we just don't get that's a privilege in itself to pick up the phone and say, hey, can I borrow $500? And $500 for some people can cost them their whole livelihood.
Will these types of resources be there on site in proximity for these young people who are in the transitional housing?
Yes. So they'll have access to emergency funding, miscellaneous funding, housing navigation, advocacy services, direct access to legal supports, support with navigating, whether it's Social Security or food share or Medicare. They'll get that from us. We'll provide them with transportation, job readiness by connecting with outside agencies who will come in and do training. We'll do our own in-house training based on our Supporting Healthy Families curriculum that we model all of our programs after, supporting people in identifying the scripts and stories that impact their ability to cause and create a reality in a world that they desire to experience. So it'll be all in-house, along with intensive case management and, you know, individualized stability plans and goal setting. And we'll support them in obtaining those goals by working with them daily.
It would, I'd imagine then you would be working very closely with social service agencies and other nonprofits to be able to provide this level of resources.
Absolutely. We are founded on collaboration and cooperation, understanding that our capacity to serve the people that are most vulnerable comes directly from our ability to collaborate. So we are really big into partnerships and networking with agencies and creating direct access points. And then the referral system for this particular program will come directly from social services agencies. So the folks that will be placed will come directly from those agencies.
This is an age group, Brandy, that might be headed to college, might be looking at higher education, maybe thinking it's out of reach or trying to transition into further education. How could higher ed be part of this transition from foster care to adulthood?
I think the mentorship and access to alternative pathways to academics, academia, would be a positive. I think like the Odyssey program would be a perfect fit for our program and figuring out how we can connect our youth to that program, which is an alternative to entering UW. And it's an amazing program. So those programs designed around assisting folks who may not qualify in the normal, you know, application process, and also offering other supports like research, staff, tutors, mentors, professors, all those folks can have an impact in how well this program works. So we are going to be doing intentional outreach to UW to see what kind of supports they can offer, even interns, right? Like, how can we get youth that are or young adults who are in college to intern at our housing facility for their own experience and for the support of the youth? So there's a lot of entry points here to support this program.
And then in terms of your timeline, what is the timeline to enroll youth and to open up services?
Well, I'm not sure if you know this, but anytime you contract out with a municipality, it's never the way you think it's going to go. So our program was actually supposed to be officially launching April 1st, and it got pushed back because there was some permit that was not secured. So we're pushed back into June or July before we get access to the actual facility to get in there to do the renovations. So I'm hoping that we can be up and running by September. That is my goal. But that is not a guarantee because contracts, you know, we just have to wait till we get the okay. And sometimes it takes longer than we would like, but hopefully by the end of the year for sure.
Well, Brandy, all the best to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're so welcome. Thanks again for having me.
Brandy Grayson is CEO of the Madison-based nonprofit Urban Triage.
This year marks the 40th anniversary of Bruce Springsteen's album, Born in the USA.
A Wisconsin music writer has a new book about the album, its popularity and impact, and what it tells us about the idea of the heartland in American culture.
Next week, we'll hear from author Stephen Hyden of Appleton about why the album meant so much to him and to the country.
And we want to hear from you. Is there an album in your life that had a huge impact on you, that shaped your musical interests or defined an era in your memory?
call now. Tell us about it. Here's the number, 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Call in and leave a voicemail or text. We'd love to share your album on a future show.
And you can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Kate, hard to pick just one. Go.
Well, in that era, Janet Jackson, Control. It was in my Sony Walkman.
Also the 40th anniversary of Prince, Purple Rain. Big one for that era for me. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.